All right, hi everybody, and welcome to lecture 61 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the elementary class. This is our last lecture on the decline and fall of Greece. Let me show you what our schedule is like coming up. So, next week is going to be a test week, but it is going to be a little bit of a curious week as well, because look at February 2016 here, right? We have, why can't I get more of this than I don't know why it's not, it's doing the exact opposite I wanted. I'm trying to zoom in, but it's not working. So anyway, it says right here, right? Washington's birthday on Monday. So we definitely celebrate that. And then, well, next week, that makes next week a short week. So on this is going to be tricky. I'm going to have to send you guys the test preparation sheets. I'm going to send them to you on Monday anyways. Okay, so that you still have 3 days. So you're going to get your test prep sheets on Monday. We're going to do a review session on Tuesday, and then art on Wednesday, and then the test prep class on Thursday. But that's the only way to work it in a short week. We're not going to have any new material next week. We're ending with the new material today. All right, so that's how it's going to work. And then after our test, we get a nice Mr. Powell February break. That's my birthday, by the way, so that's why we have a February break. And there's lots of reasons why we have a February break. Teachers desperately need February breaks. So, all right, so that's what's going on in the next couple weeks here. So let's get moving here with Alexander the Great and the story of this part of Greece that has never been important until now, right? We have talked about Athens and Sparta, by far the two most important, and then, oh, all of a sudden Thebes kind of jumps up and becomes more important for a little while, and then strangely, because of Thebes, this backward part of Greece called Macedon all of a sudden gets catapulted up to the top. Because one of the princes of Macedon, Philip, becomes a hostage of our Epaminondas character, the one who invents the new phalanx, right? And yeah, when you get here late, you have to be quiet. Okay, so now, Epaminondas teaches Philip how to perform all of these maneuvers and tactics and so on. So the Macedonians, these more backward people, are able to conquer the rest of Greece. And then Philip dies and his son Alexander takes over. So we started looking at the story of Alexander last time, and this map dramatically captures just the size of what he did, or a better word for it would be the scope of it. The scope means the extent of what he accomplished, which obviously geographically it's pretty hard to really fathom how big this is. I think a pretty straightforward way to do it is this. The extent of this empire is comparable to the United States of America. So if you want to think size, how big it is, this is about the size of the U.S. Now, that's not modern times. There's no transcontinental railway. There's no 747 flying from New York to L.A., right? There's none of that wonderful stuff to get around. This is an archaic empire the size of the United States. So that is not easy to do. Of course, the Persians were the ones that had really created it. And now Alexander's taking advantage of that and moving really quickly through it. And we traced his path through this empire when he crossed over into Asia, right, and across what we call the Hellespont, right here, going the other way, defeated the satrap of Lydia over there, came here and liberated these Greek colonies, went and cut the Gordian knot, which meant that he was going to become the ruler of Asia, and then headed down here and combated the Persian king Darius III at Issus and defeated him, went down here to Tyre, the island fortress that we saw yesterday that was cool, and built a land bridge across to it and attacked it from the sea and conquered that, and then came down and, quote, liberated Egypt. Now, I want to be careful to say, quote, liberated here, because the idea of liberty and the expression liberate, those deserve to be used when they actually mean that. What does the word liberate mean? That is a very great word. What does it mean to liberate somebody? Opal?
It means to set free.
Yeah, to give liberty, right? To set free. All right, so when the United States liberated France from Nazi Germany, wow, that was liberation, right? That was giving freedom to people, right? When the Russians, quote, liberated Poland from the Germans, that wasn't liberation. They just took it and made a different ruler. So, yeah, I mean, they might call that liberation in history books, but they're really abusing that word. Liberation means giving liberty, setting free. So, when Alexander came down to Egypt, did he liberate Egypt? Well, we would measure that and we would say, well, did he give those people, those poor peasants who have pharaohs always ruling over them, did he set them free? That would be the real question. Well, we answered that partly yesterday. He did not. Instead of getting rid of pharaohs, what did he do? Patrick?
He became the pharaoh.
He became the pharaoh, right? That's just like the Russians taking over Eastern Europe after World War II, for those of you who know about it, right? It's just a different ruler taking over. So getting rid of one ruler, but just a new one instead. So that's how Alexander behaved when he got there. So it wasn't liberating. And he's behaving like a pharaoh. And then if we continue to follow his path, it's kind of interesting. We're going to see a little bit of a clue about Alexander in this last segment of his activity way over here. He goes over to a place called the Ammon Oracle, which, now let me see what I got here. Yeah, is this location here in Egypt, known to this day as the Siwa Oasis. So look where it is, way over in the heart of the Sahara Desert. And it's an oasis, right? So that means a small area, which amazingly has water and life in the middle of the desert. And in ancient times, there was an oracle there. And, well, it had a reputation, maybe a greater reputation than the Oracle at Delphi, for being able to tell the future. So Alexander wanted to go there, and nobody knows what he asked the oracle. But it does seem to be that he wanted to know if he was going to succeed in what he was going to do and if he could make himself into a god king. And that, sadly, is what we are going to see him do. We see him becoming the pharaoh, and now we want to. And now what we're going to see, sadly, is that Alexander is going to basically copy the Persians. He's going to act like them, and that this is part, a very important part of this idea of the decline of Greece. Because if the leader of Greece is not standing up for the things that are great about Greece, then all that wonderful progress is going to disappear. And Alexander, sadly, is going to now behave like a pharaoh, and he's going to behave like a supposedly Persian god king. And that's going to really ruin things. By the way, this is something neat that I found that is a little bit of the evidence of Alexander's activities in Egypt. Remember what an oval, or this is called a cartouche, what it means. What object had cartouches on it, and then a certain person named Champollion figured out what the cartouches were. Crucial anchor fact of archaic history. Without it, we don't know any Egyptian history. Sigourney?
The Rosetta Stone.
The Rosetta Stone. And just quick review here to see how you guys are doing on your memory. When was the Rosetta Stone discovered? Ooh, good. Patrick, as the hand shoots up. Go ahead.
1799.
Excellent. Okay, good. So that's the beginning of Egyptology. And so now, with Egyptology alive and well, then we can go to Egypt and we can read Egyptian hieroglyphs. And as it turns out, this one, we've got to read it kind of backwards because it didn't go left to right. It goes right to left. Ah. Licks. Ender. Or more Greek. Alexander in Greek is Alexandros. So that's why we have the extra S at the end. So if you want to know how to write Alexander in Egyptian hieroglyphs, here it is, folks. Alexandros. They didn't have vowels. I don't know what this... that's why sometimes when you read things like Tutankhamun or Tutankhamen, people are just choosing a certain vowel to use because there weren't any vowels. So, or at least we can't know what they were. The Egyptians might have had a habit of using certain ones. But anyway, cool, right? Alexander's hieroglyph. Here it is. Opal, Zen, go ahead.
Say that it looks like there's a dog and a bird in there, but a bunch of other kind of unrecognizable shapes. But you can kind of tell what they are.
Yeah, certainly. And so you've got some shapes, and you've got a squiggle, and looks like an eye, and a feather, and yeah, all of these things are, well, we call them pictographs, or in Egyptian we call them hieroglyphs. So they're picture writing, right? And so that's how we get Alexander. And, well, we have monuments throughout Egypt that show Alexander went to different temples and rebuilt some of them and was the pharaoh of Egypt. He was literally the pharaoh of Egypt. So he acted this way. Anyway, so would this be easy to read? No, probably not, right? But anyway, just thought I'd show you because it is kind of fascinating. So here's Alexander's empire. And so now he has gone to Egypt. And the next phase of it is to try to hunt down the Persian emperor. He has defeated him, so he's gone. And quickly here, this is the path, right? And then he goes here, then he goes to the oasis and comes back. All right, and so now he goes back here, and he's hunting the Persian emperor. He wants to force him to fight. And you might be able to make out, although you have to zoom in here, that there's this important battle here that occurs. It's called the Battle of Gaugamela. So what happens at the Battle of Gaugamela? Remember yesterday, did we talk about how a small army can beat a big army? Yesterday? I'm going to show you the Battle of Gaugamela here in a very simplified form, how a small army can beat a big army. Opal, put your hand down. It's confusing. So here we have this massive Persian army with all of these are like special corps, special groups of massive amounts of soldiers. Henry, watch your chat. That's really too goofy. Pay attention, please. So we got this massive Persian empire, Persian army, and then we have all these cavalry units, these ones with the lines across,
and these guys are chariots. And so now that the Greek army is a lot smaller, right? And so how are you going to win? Well, it's kind of neat. This is the beginning of the battle on the left, and this is how Alexander won, even though he had a smaller army. Does anybody recognize what the Persians tried to do? What's this called when the army goes around both flanks? Rosetta? Yes, but there's a name for the maneuver that was used at the Battle of Marathon. So yeah, this is trying to surround. Opal?
Enveloping.
Yes, the double envelopment maneuver. Except it's not being done right. There's a thing that has to be done in order to really make the double envelopment maneuver work. The double envelopment, first what you do is you withdraw. So your idea is to get the other army to commit moving forward. You've got to trick them into moving forward so that you can get around them. This is a really basic attempt, kind of raw attempt by the Persians. The Persian king was probably thinking, I got such a big army. I'm sending some of my guys over here, some of them. We're going to do the double envelopment no matter what. That kind of thing. But what happened was, and here is where you get the genius of a commander like Alexander. All of these forces here move over here. So he sends some of his over to the left to block them. All of these forces over here trying to move fast to go around this side. So he's already ready for that. So he's already got his facing that way and ready to stop them on either side. But what does it do when all of this moves out of the way? Now this is the smart part. It creates, and here it is, it's labeled in the second part of the diagram. It creates an opening. And where's Darius? Well, he's now more exposed than ever before. So what Alexander can do, because he's waiting for this, he's expecting it. What Alexander can do then is take all these forces in the center and push. And all of a sudden, at this spot, the battle is in his favor. Not everywhere else. Now, first of all these guys back here, they're useless. They're not even in the battle because they're in the wrong place. These guys are busy. These guys are busy. So they're taken care of. Some of these guys are making the mistake of going forward. And then meanwhile, he's got the advantage in one spot. All of this goes forward. Bam, go fast. So now his side with this big dark arrow is a perfect symbol, right? All of the power goes in one place. So remember what we said about a small army fighting a large army. The small army has to make a small battle. Has to take away the advantage of the large army. How do you make a small battle against a big army? Well, it's not easy. Each commander has to find the trick at the moment. And the answer here was to let the Persians try to surround you. And go ahead, let them do that. And take advantage of that to find a gap in what they have done. And go there. That's the spot. That's the one little weak point. And so all of a sudden, Alexander applies all the power in one place. And what Darius does is he panics. Which is not surprising because he's all of a sudden he realizes, oh, I can't call these guys back. Why not? Why can't he call these guys back? This is a really big battlefield. Patrick, why not?
Because they're fighting the others, which is sort of a distraction just to take them away.
Yeah, but they're very far away and they're fighting. In modern warfare, the commander can use the radio and call them back, right? But not in ancient warfare. He can't command these people anymore. By making his decision at the beginning, he's lost control of them. He gave them a job. They're doing it. So now he doesn't have them in his army anymore. Whereas all of Alexander's forces are well coordinated and close to each other, and they can attack really well. So this was what Alexander was especially good at, was making a small battle out of a big battle. So it doesn't matter if your army is smaller, as long as you can win the battle that counts, the one in the center, the one where the other emperor, well, the other commander runs away, and then his army falls apart. Pretty cool. All right, so Alexander wins the Battle of Gaugamela, and then, as you can see, he comes and he enters the heart of Mesopotamia. And you guys will all be eager to see this. Guess what this is? Who do you think it is? Who do you think is the guy in gold? The young man on the powerful white chariot, Patrick?
I do remember doing this painting in History Through Art, and that is Alexander.
That is Alexander the Great. Yes. So what is this painting? Well, here we have the text that we came up with as a team, right? At the head of his conquering army, a successful but somber, golden-clad figure on an elephant-drawn chariot enters a defeated city as its new ruler. Parade of Conquest. Entry of the Conqueror. Yeah, that's what this painting is by Charles Le Brun. The Entry of Alexander into Babylon, the great city at the heart of Mesopotamia. So there it is. Let me go ahead and type that into the chat for you just for a sec here, because here's our, is that the first of the History Through Art paintings that we really had a chance to bring back? No, we probably had some others, but it's cool when we do finally bring it back, right? So this is Entry into Babylon. Right? Babylon is the city in the center of Mesopotamia, and these back here are the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Way up in the sky, you know, high at the top of a big structure there. This was the most famous monument, and this is a famous gate that you would enter into the city. And so here's Alexander in his triumphant procession. All right, well, so now Alexander is the pharaoh. Now Alexander is the ruler of Mesopotamia, and he is hunting down the Persian emperor. The Persian emperor runs away and his power collapses. And there's a little story here that's not that important about him trying to capture the Persian emperor. And in the end, the Persian emperor was killed by one of his own satraps in order to try to curry favor, which means to try to do something for Alexander so that he would be treated well. So the Persian emperor was was killed by one of his own satraps, which of course is a pretty good symbol of what the Persians thought of themselves, of each other. So they didn't exactly even respect each other. So Alexander now is the ruler of this empire. And well, what's he going to do? He now controls it, but he is increasingly thinking of himself as a god king, as some kind of invincible god king who can take over the whole world. And what he knows of the world is that, well, he didn't know all of geography back then. So Alexander thinks that the world will end not far off of this map, that the whole of the world pretty much only goes that far. He knows by Greek geography that it goes a little further west, but he doesn't really think there's anything interesting over there, and there isn't yet. And then, but he knows that there's more to the east, so he wants to keep going east. And as he goes further, the further east that he goes, the more that he becomes like an Asian ruler. the more that he becomes like a Persian emperor, like somebody who thinks he's a god, in that regular people don't matter. So, in order to kind of make himself like this, he starts to demand that his Greek comrades behave towards him as if he is a Persian emperor, as if he is a god, not just another man. And he demands that they act towards him. Well, here is a great symbol of how you are supposed to act towards a god king. Right? This is a mural from probably ancient Assyria, something like that. Right? Ancient Mesopotamia. And what are you supposed to do in the presence of a god king? Well, you are supposed to... Oh no, we got the chat is a little bit out of control here today, folks. I don't like that. Henry, Opal, I want better from you guys. So, anyway, whether it's private or public, okay? Control the chat. So, this is the vocabulary word of the day. What do we call this act of bending forward and kissing the ground and putting your forehead straight to the ground where the ruler stands because you are not worthy of being in his presence? This is called proskynesis. So what it means is you bend over and you touch your head to the ground. Why? Because you are just a person and the king is a god. You are not worthy of being in his presence. So this was a court ritual in the Persian Empire. This was something that is common throughout Asia. Later on in European history, when the British are going to get to China, they're going to see that the Chinese emperor expects exactly the same thing. And the Persian emperor expected this. And so now Alexander wanted to be treated this way. He wanted this because he wanted the people that he was conquering to think of him just like the other emperors. So now he's demanding that his own Greek commanders act like this. Act towards him like the poor peasants and poor people of Mesopotamia are supposed to act towards a god king. Proskynesis. So that's the court ritual that he demanded that they enact. Now, if you're Greek, what are you going to think of this? What do we know about the Greeks? Henry?
They won't like it.
Good answer. Yeah, good answer. They won't like it. Because to the Greeks, what is a king? That's kind of a deep question, but let's see if you guys can do it. To the Greeks, what is a king? What did we see, for instance, in the story of Athenian democracy? Wyatt, go ahead.
Well, they just kind of think of a king as another person who, by force, is controlling them.
Excellent. Perfect. The Greeks, exactly. Thank you, Wyatt. The Greeks just thought of a king as another person. Okay? A person just like them. And we saw that the Greeks didn't have any worries about, for instance, overthrowing a king and having a tyrannos in charge instead, right? What's a tyrannos? A king chosen by the people. They didn't have any thought that somehow a king was a god. They didn't believe in that sort of stuff. So they themselves thought that pretty much any person can be the ruler as long as he does a good job. So now this idea of proskynesis was very different than the Greek idea. A Greek man would not kneel before a god, right? That just not some king who pretends to be a god. So definitely his command, Alexander's commanders hated this. And eventually they got, so there was a fight between Alexander and one of his commanders named Clytus. And Clytus was one of his greatest generals. And they were arguing at a party that they were having after having conquered another part of the empire. And sadly, in the fight, Alexander became enraged. And in this sketch here that we see, he killed one of his best friends and most important commanders, Clytus. So things were going badly here, right? Alexander was trying to behave more and more like a Persian king, and his own men were hating it. They did not like that. It was insulting to them. They did not want to become like the Persians. They wanted to rule the Persians, but they didn't want to be Persians. Alexander believed that that was the only way to do it. And so he insisted that they do that. But eventually this didn't work out, because here we got Alexander's empire as he's expanding further and further to the east. Notice how far it's going. Notice how far it's going all the way over here. Alexander's empire stretched all the way to India. That's as far as he was able to take it in the east. And he crossed this river here, which is called the Indus River, one of the most important rivers in archaic history as well. Just like the Nile and the Tigris and the Euphrates, the Indus River right here. And he won one last battle right here, called the Battle of the Hydaspes, which is one of the tributaries of the river. And, well, that was it. His own commander said, no more. We are not going to continue to whatever you think the end of the world is. We don't care. We are Greek. Look where we are. We got no business being over here. We don't want to die over here in the middle of nowhere to us, right? Where is our home? Our home is way over here. We're Greek. We don't want this anymore. And so Alexander could not convince his own commanders to keep going. So you can follow their path here on this map. I'm going to need a little bit of a reminder, but Mrs. Powell will probably give us the reminder. I've got to put this map on the class webpage for you guys, because it is quite a great map and you can zoom in on it. So here he sails down the river and then goes by land and by sea back to the heart of the Persian Empire. And then he died a mysterious death. He was very young and he got some kind of a fever. You know, maybe it was something like malaria or something like that. Diseases a lot of diseases come from mosquitoes and stuff like that. How young was he? I'm not sure if we know exactly when he was born, but he was still young. I think he was still in his 30s when he died. So I'm not sure. It's probably somewhere online that people would have guessed when he was born. Anyway, still very young. And well, now that he's dead, what's going to happen? Because what we call an empire like this, that is made by a single person, there's a name for it. It's a certain kind of empire or monarchy that is based on the greatness of one individual. So you might not remember this, but it's called a charismatic monarchy. Does anybody know what that means? It includes this other vocabulary word, charisma. Does anybody know what that means? Well, of all the people in the modern world who've got it, I guess I could say one of them is Donald Trump. And he's becoming very famous lately, isn't he? Right? So charisma is the energy of a leader. Somebody that people are excited by because he finds a way to get them really excited. He's a leader. And people are willing to follow. So charismatic leaders are these special individuals that have this ability to convince everybody else to do what they want them to do. But what happens when a charismatic monarchy ends? When the empire was built only because of the greatness of one person, what happens when that person is gone? What makes the most sense? Let's finish up here. Nobody can get it? If an empire requires one person and that person's gone, what happens to it, Sigourney?
The empire collapses.
Exactly. The empire collapses. So the empire of Alexander fell apart. And I don't have a particularly good map of it. This one's not even in English. But what this map shows us is that the empire of Alexander broke up immediately into four parts. The Persian part in yellow, the Egyptian part in purple, the Lydian part in orange, and the Greek part in green. That's it. So immediately after Alexander, everything that he tried to do broke up right back into the pieces that it was in before. And it didn't last. So by the time the Romans come around, things have gone back to the way they were. All of these are weak and separate kingdoms. And the Romans are going to come and they're going to conquer the whole thing. All right, so that's what we're going to talk about, of course, when we return after the test and everything. We're going to get to the Romans and what they are going to do here. So, Opal, Zen, what's up?
I didn't mean that my hand raised. It's acting funny. I don't know what's going on. Maybe I can turn it off now.
Okay,
now it's working.
All right. Okay. All right, then. So, there we go. Sadly, this is where the story of Greece is going to end. There's nothing else important to say. Yes, there is a Greece. And yes, there's even democracy in Athens. But it's weak. And it is not the kind of confident and democracy that these people that are excited about how they are going to make life better. Instead, they're people that have fought each other so long and they're tired of it and they really don't have anything else to contribute. So it's a really sad thing, and we're not going to study that long, drawn out, boring part of Greek history. It's not worth it. It's just a really sad chapter of history. So when we come back after the test, it's going to be Rome. Okay, guys. That's it. That's the last of the new material. Talk to you tomorrow in History Through Art. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.